And are you Craig?
I'm Craig Smith.
You're Craig. Okay. Welcome and lead on.
Thank you, sir. Senator Morris, members of the committee, my name is Craig Smith. I'm the administrator of the Construction Contractors Board. Our chair is Jim Fairchild. Jim is the mayor of Dallas, Oregon, and he informed me over the weekend that something came up that's going to prevent him from being here this morning, so he regrets that. But he asked me to share with you that he feels his budget is important, and perhaps he can make the Phase 2 and Phase 3 presentations. In front of you, you should have a copy of our presentation. There's a table of contents. Page double I is merely a quick fact sheet to give you some references to what the agency is all about. Triple I is the board members. As you know, this is a policy board. There are 9 board members throughout the state of Oregon. This gives you an idea of who they are, where they come from, and their geographical location. Today's presentation is about the Construction Contractors Board, which is the state agency that licenses construction contractors and certified home inspectors. The board holds contractors accountable for their business practices by protecting consumers through its 5 major programs. Those programs include consumer education, contractor education, licensing and customer service, the enforcement division, which is contractor discipline, and then the dispute resolution program, which is a program that's a little bit like a court system, mediation. It involves claims filed usually by homeowners against contractors to get access to their bond. This is the Phase 1 presentation. In this presentation, I will be describing the agency's mission, goals, and its history, describing the agency's organizational structure, and describing program details, performance measures, and the agency's prioritized list of 10% reduction options. That takes me to page 1 of the presentation, which is the agency's mission. The mission of the Construction Contractors Board is to protect the public's interest related to improvements to real property. The board regulates construction contractors and promotes a competitive business environment through education, contractor licensing, dispute resolution, and enforcement of laws. We have 3 major goals. The first goal is to protect Oregon consumers of construction-related services. Second goal is to provide excellent customer service to all that wish to use our services. And lastly, to regulate in a manner that supports a fair, honest, and competitive business environment in the construction industry. We have related objectives to each goal. I won't read those, but I'll move on and we'll refer to those later on in the presentation. I'm on page 3 now. This is merely a recitement of the agency's statutory authority. You'll find that in ORS 701. The short title of this chapter is the Construction Contractor Board Licensing Act. In the year 2000, the board, in May, completed a detailed 5-year business plan. That business plan has been in place since that time and will be updated for the year 2005-2009 later on this fall. Things contained in that business plan include find and stop contractors who are operating illegally, make consumers and contractors aware of their rights and responsibility and the role and authority of the regulator, Construction Contractors Board, develop better ways that contractors can understand and how to operate their business in a lawful and responsible manner, improve our efficiency in order that, as far as when we do resolve construction disputes and contractor disciplinary actions, improve the value, speed, and accuracy, the thoroughness and cost effectiveness of information that we deliver to consumers, contractors, and our other customers, discover and implement ways to process the ever-increasing workload without increased staff, if possible, and provide information to you and others that make policy decisions. Major program changes. The Builders Board was a creation of 1971 legislature. It was housed in the Department of Commerce. A few of the program changes over the year include, in 1987, When the Department of Commerce was abolished, the Construction Contractor Board, then Builders Board, went out on its own. It combined with the Landscape Board to try to provide staff and resources necessary for those licensing programs. In 1990, the Builders Board name changed because instead of just residential contractors, you chose to regulate the entire construction industry, including commercial contractors. In 1997, there was a push in Oregon that actually leads the nation, I think, in the regulation of certified home inspectors. These are the people that come to your home when you want to buy a new house and take a look at it before you buy a used home and give you some kind of a report as to whether or not the thing's going to fall apart now or later. In the year 2000, hearings rep, this was a big year, 2000. Many of you were there at the time. We moved the hearings officers from the Construction Contractors Board and many other agencies to the Department of Employment. We created a special hearings, or we created a special investigations unit. You gave the Construction Contractors Board additional regulatory authorities that had to do with commercial projects. You changed the registration from a registration to a license. That's when there was a test started for new contractors. In 2004, there was a couple of program changes that you may want to be aware of. They instituted a fee and a notice requirement for resolving construction disputes. You'll hear later that that has had a significant effect on the claims processed by the agency. It's reduced claims by about 45%. I'd like to go over and give you a brief review now of the agency's programs and their target groups. Agency programs, as I mentioned before, include consumer education. We think this is where we can get the best bang for the buck. If you can convince a consumer that it has a responsibility when it transacts for business to make sure they understand what they're doing when they buy a home or when they buy a home improvement, you can prevent construction disputes. We do that through home shows, business fairs, things we have on the website, some other minor public relations. Frankly, we don't do enough, and we hope to do more in the future. Contractor education has been around for about 10 years now. This is the education for business practices and the other laws that affect contractors. That culminated in a testing requirement in the year 2000, as I've talked about. It seems to be fairly successful. We've got around 8,000 of our licensees now that have a person involved with the business that have taken this test. And it seems to be having an effect on the amount of bankruptcies, a dramatic effect. Now, we don't know for sure, but it's difficult to measure the effect of an education program. We've chosen in Construction Contractors Board to try to look at the ratio of bankruptcy from tested contractors versus non-tested contractors. And the raw statistics over these last few years show a tremendous advantage for people who have taken these tests. And we think that is because they learn a little bit more about business. And the problem that many contractors have is not that they're not good tradespeople, but they run into trouble when they're trying to run their Construction Contractors Board business, whether it be the regulations or the accounting, these types of things. Perhaps at its core is the agency's licensing activities and its customer service. These are the folks that take in the paperwork, make sure the contractor has the financial accountability in the form of the bond and the insurance. Many of you are aware that insurance has been a big problem for construction contractors and for others, medical malpractice, that sort of thing. Contractors have suffered a great deal with insurance, and we see a lot of contractors lose their insurance during their licensing period. If the contractor loses their insurance coverage for whatever reason, their license goes lapse. And there's a lot of paper going back and forth between the agency and insurance agencies trying to make sure that the contractor's license is not valid at a time when they don't have proper insurance. We do have a license capacity now of about 42,000 contractors. Again, there are both applications for new contractors, about 400 a month. We renew about 1,200 to 1,500 contractors a month. Surety bonds are not a problem, and they're not the same kind of problem that insurance is. We also keep track of tax ID numbers. And, of course, the program targets for this particular program are both contractors and consumers. Consumers use the information to make buying decisions. Contractors use the program to make sure that they have their license in good order. The enforcement program uses about 20% of the agency resources. These are the folks that take away licenses when a contractor runs afoul of the law or penalizes contractors for working without a license. They also take a license away when a contractor has developed a construction debt. It could be a CCB claim. It could be a court action, or it could be some other action where the contractor is shown to be not financially accountable. That section issues warnings in some cases, civil penalties, suspensions. We will inspect thousands of job sites every year looking for unlicensed activity. The program targets, of course, are, for the most part, non-compliant contractors.
Excuse me. Question?
Yeah, thank you. And do you visit a job site that has a major complaint against contractors? I mean, is there some kind of intervention? I guess I'm looking for the process of enforcement. And as far as your agency is concerned.
Senator Morris, Senator Morissette, the process, we have actually three parts of the enforcement program. One part is completely done by service contracts. These are people that are located in the communities themselves. They're private investigators. Their job, for the most part, is respond to local complaints about non-licensed activity and to do what we call cold site checks. They will go into the job site if they receive a telephone complaint or a web complaint looking for non-licensed activity.
I'm talking about licensed contractors who, according to the homeowner, completely screw up. That's what I'm talking about. And I may have to bring you more specifics, and you may not be here tomorrow, and if you're not, I will get in touch with you because there is a constituent, well, actually not a constituent, but he has engaged a number of legislators in his particular problem in Lane County. That's gone on for quite a while, and I want to get some information, but I can contact you later on this.
Okay, sir. Could be Mr. Varco.
Yes. You're familiar with that one, right?
I am. Yes. We're working with some legislators and the Building Codes Division on Mr. Varco's situation.
Okay. Well, I'd still like to talk with you about where you are on that investigation at some point. Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
I've never seen something that I call such as uproar in terms of contracting and so on. So, thank you.
Yes. One of the sections of the Construction Contractors Board is dispute resolution. These are the claims that are filed by homeowners or other contractors against contractors alleging a breach of contract for negligent or improper work or failure to complete the job. This, again, is kind of a unique program. Most states don't have this. It serves to hold contractors accountable for their business practices because although the service at this point costs $50 to have a processing fee, but we still receive hundreds of claims a month against contractors who allegedly haven't done what they promised to do. It could be code violation. It could be a cosmetic issue. In some cases, they've taken the money and not done the work. What this section does is it liquefies or establishes whether or not the contractor did the job well. In many cases, it solves a good faith dispute between the consumer and the contractor, and the board doesn't have to order anything to be done. But rather it's just writes a settlement agreement, the contractor goes ahead and fixes the job, and all is well. In some cases, however, the contractor has either left the state or refuses to do the work, and in those cases the board orders monetary damages, If the contractor doesn't pay those damages, then the agency takes that license away, prohibits that licensee from operating, and prohibits all the owners of that licensee, in the case of a corporation or an LLC, from holding that license or any other license in this state until that debt's paid. In many in those cases, there are over $12 million of awards per biennium.
Chair?
Yes. Question?
You say it prevents them from holding that license or any other license. I assume you mean any other professional license that the state gives. Is there a network set up between all the licensing boards where you share that kind of information so they don't issue licenses?
Senator Morris and Representative Avakian, I didn't mean to say that we prevent them from holding any other kind of professional license, but what sometimes happens is that I might form an LLC, have a problem with that LLC, and before we had the laws changed, a person could just dump that corporation or dump that limited liability company and go form a new one. And what we do is we hold the human beings behind the corporate or limited liability company responsible for the debts of that company. So they're not able to hold a construction contractor's board license in any form until the debt of the old company is paid.
Okay. Thank you.
So those are the programs for the Construction Contractors Board. We've got a couple of another slide here to show you from an organizational standpoint how that works. We have the Construction Contractors Board, 9-member board that I answer to, and then the programs with a little bit of a program description there on page 8. Page 9 shows some of the recent demand for agency services. I'll talk a little bit about just the license. 15 years ago, we had about 17,000 licenses. We had a high of just over 45 in 2000, 45,000. Today, we sit at approximately 42,000 licensees. We've had a ramp up of the education necessary for new applicants, beginning again in the year 2000, to today, approximately 3,000 a year. Enforcement actions have been fairly static since the year 2000. Claims is perhaps the area where we've had the biggest movement. And you can see that these are yearly figures. 15 years ago, about 2,000 claims a year. 5 years ago, about 4,400. Just in 2003, almost 5,000, and we're down to 3,000 in 2004. And that number is probably high for what we'll see in the future. And again, the big change here, we'll get to it a little bit, is the filters, I'll call them, that we instituted last session, wherein a consumer is required today to write a letter to the contractor before they file a claim. And all the letter has to say is, look, we've got a problem. If you don't come to address it within 30 days, I'm filing the claim and I'm going to mark up your license. Once that's done, the agency evaluates the claim. Once the claim is filed, it ensures that the agency has jurisdiction. Jurisdictional issues have to do with whether or not the job was done in Oregon, whether it was really construction work, whether it was with a licensed contractor. And if indeed we've got jurisdiction, then we send an invoice, if you will, to the consumer for $50. Most of the time the consumer isn't, and that's not a problem. Go ahead and pays that. We do have a provision if we really have a problem with income, we can waive that fee. But at the end of the day, if it's determined that the contractor is responsible for this debt, and as you see, about $12 million of biennium, they are found to be so, we will order the contractor to pay that $50 back to the consumer.
May I ask another question?
Can you file a claim after you bought off on the work of the contractor? Someone's building a new home and you sign off on it, then if you start finding things wrong with it, can you then still file a legitimate claim?
Good question, Senator Morris. That's exactly right. It's up to a year after the homeowner's taken possession. And what can happen, of course, is even though it looks good when you move in, you might end up with some nail pops or find some other things during the course while you're living in the home. Page 10 is a slide that shows the relative workload most recently during this biennium. It's difficult to see with the black and white copy here, but what it shows is that we have a fairly steady, slight increase in the number of licensees and a bit of an upturn in the number of claims and a fairly constant level of enforcement actions. The board does its work, and I'm on page 11 now, through itself, but it has several subcommittees, if you will, that helps it with its policy making and decision making. On page 11, that shows that committee structure. It has one committee that's just for training and education activities. This is to ensure that the education that we're providing to contractors on point and is the best quality we can have it. The other advisory committee has to do with home inspectors. And this kind of flows from 97 when you gave that authority to the contractors board. In a way, it's not a real good fit, home inspectors and contractors, because home inspectors really don't build anything. They inspect, they provide a report. It's a different line of business than contractors. And in many states, that's regulatory function is set over at the real estate division, because it seems to fit. And a lot of times when somebody is buying a piece of real estate, an older home, they're going to need a home inspection report. So it makes some sense to have it over there, but we're happy to have it with us. And home inspectors are a very interesting group. There are about 400 or 500 of them, and we're pleased to serve them. The other committees that we have to do with information technology. Was very, very active a few years ago as our changes in technology have stabilized. That's not as active as it once was. And cases before the board in terms of taking any kind of a penalty or when we do have a contested case proceeding, and it goes through the hearings officer panel, those matters can be appealed to the board. And in years past, we've had a small subcommittee of the board, three members rotated. Today, we use the entire board as its appeal committee. These are important decisions that have to do with contract disputes, but also the livelihood of some contractors when we're trying to suspend or revoke a license. Page 12 is simply an organizational chart. It's more adept to personnel issues. I'm going to go through these and go to page 14 because it's a little, I can understand it, a little better than the other ones. This shows how the agency is put together, again, with the board on top, the subcommittees underneath, the administration, and then a level line of all six programs that the Construction Contractors Board uses to facilitate its operations. Very briefly, I think it's instructive to go through these. We have a small administrative section that takes care of the business operations of the agency as well as the budget. We have what works very well for us is the Information Technology Center that constantly is updating our business operations to provide better service to our clients. We have the consumer and contractor education programs. This, again, is perhaps the sparsest staffed section of the agency. We get a big, big bang for the buck out of those folks, but we hope to get more resources there. One of the problems with this, and I don't want to call it a problem, but it's a challenge, is we have outsourced the testing and the education. So those aren't state people providing those. That may be a good thing. But in order to have good contracts, those RFPs need to be designed well. They need to be monitored well. We do get complaints from time to time about people who have gone through either our education or our testing suggesting that it wasn't all it ought to be. And we have to have conversations then with those vendors and continually consider changes to those contracts that are going to make sure we have the best programs available at the lowest possible cost.
Thank you. That's the question of who are the vendors and why did you outsource? And is it economic and efficient?
Senator Morris? Senator Morissette? I think the answer to that is that's the way it was. It's difficult to get FTEs. It's difficult. Uh-huh. I think that, when these programs, particularly in the middle 90s, came about, there was no stomach for growing the size of government in terms of public employment. And it made sense to those folks to have this outsourced. Is it working? I'd say yes. I think the industry wants it that way. The education providers are kind of a myriad of different people. In many cases, they provide education for other things besides just education of contractors. They're private. We do contract with some university or colleges. And then the testing is by a national company. I don't want to get my acronym in trouble here.
PSX National. Professional.
All I can tell you is that the acronym is PSI. I regret not knowing the name of it. But this is a national company that handles many, many state contractor testing and other types of testing. Seems to work pretty well. Again, paramount to the function of the agency is its licensing and customer service programs. Those have been developed throughout the 30 years of the agency's life. It's running along pretty well right now. You can see there's a lot of staff that are involved with that program. These are the folks that are at the front desk and answering the phones and processing the paperwork, that sort of thing. One of the things we're very proud of and we get some compliments on is that we are almost completely away from any kind of voicemail. When you call the Construction Contractors Board, you're going to get a little bit of a tag, but within a very few seconds, you're going to get a live voice. And we measure how long it takes to get to that live voice. We measure whether or not people are getting accurate answers. And our customer satisfaction, by just doing that, has increased, we believe. Quite frankly, this is not the easiest program. There are a lot of little nicks and crannies. And being able to have good knowledge workers on those phones answering our customers, not only licensees or applicants, but consumers' questions is a very important thing. The enforcement program, again, is interesting because most of the prosecutorial work is done in-house. These are the people that write the penalties, do some of the orders. They write a proposed order. They will represent the agency in hearings. But other work is done off-site. These are the investigations of the job sites. For the most part, that is contracted out. We also have something that came about in 2000 called a Special Investigations Unit. This is basically designed to stop construction fraud. It's a program that works out pretty well. We've developed a good relationship with the Department of Justice and with other local law enforcement, local district attorneys, police departments, that sort of thing. And over the last 12 months particularly, we've developed some great contacts with the Portland area and out on down through the valley as well as the coast to help stop contractors that we don't even like to call them contractors. They're thieves dressed up to look like contractors. They will go around, knock on doors, take money without the intention to do the work, and run. And, you know, a civil penalty isn't going to stop that person. What's going to stop that person is being put in jail. And that's what these people do. They've had some success in it, and we hope to be able to continue it.
Excuse me, Craig. The fraud investigators, are they private contracts?
Mr. Morris, yes, sir, that's what they are. They're private contracts. It's not the cheapest kind of work. For the most part, these people are seasoned law enforcement officers.
Mm-hmm.
Several of the folks that we contract work with currently are ex-FBI folks. A lot of times you have to follow the money, as looking at bank records as well as looking at contractor sites to be able to catch these people. And quite frankly, they get paid quite a bit to do the work. But we've had pretty good performance. Again, the last program is dispute resolution. You can see this uses up about 30% of our resources, but you're looking at a mediation dispute resolution program that is resource intensive, but probably gives a pretty doggone good bang for the buck. That concludes my presentation with regard to.
May I ask one more question? How long have you been working on the Vargo case? Speaking of bang for the buck and how much involvement you have.
Senator Morris and Senator Morissette, we've been aware of Mr. Vargas's complaints for many months. In fact, he has used our dispute resolution service on many different levels. For the most part, his situation has to do with a building codes and inspection issue as much as the builder issue. I think the builder's out of business. I'm not absolutely certain. But I think the direct answer to your question is quite a period of time. And I think the biggest thing that's going to help him is some issues that have to do with local inspection issues, who's responsible, that sort of thing.
May I briefly? Yeah. So the builder may be out of business, so he probably won't get any satisfaction there. But what he told me when I've talked to him is he doesn't want it to happen to anybody else. So that could be the best thing that comes out of the case.
Right.
And he may not get any satisfaction from the builder.
Right. I'm not aware of that particular.
Yeah. We don't have to get into that in great detail because I do want to talk to you.
Okay. Very good.
Thank you.
If there's no additional questions on organizational structure, we'll get into performance measures. Okay, this is on page 15. Performance measure summary. The agency worked with the Oregon Progress Board during 2002 to develop new mission and vision statements that would allow for development of these performance measures. We do not have any Oregon benchmarks that match right up to Contractors Board, so we developed a couple of high-level outputs, outcome measurements. You can see those listed here. Beneath that are the performance measures that we developed. We continue to look at these, make sure that they are pertinent. We'll go into those in detail, so I won't talk about them in summary here unless you want me to. Page number 16 is the data source for those performance measures. Page number 17 is merely the final review by Rita Conrad. Many of you probably are aware of Rita. She works with the Progress Board. Rita was very instrumental in us being able to pick these particular performance measures. She seems to know what she's doing. Those of us who work in regulation aren't necessarily the best to pick performance measures, perhaps, and Rita is a real professional. That would take me then to the program performance measure overview. And what I've tried to do here, I should tell you that in this packet, the way we've designed it is that there are a couple of green pieces of paper here, three of them actually. Behind the first green piece of paper, that's Appendix 1, that's the entire performance measure report in numerical order. If you want to look at them in numerical order and all the information is there. Behind the second green piece of paper is the detailed statistics for licensing. A lot of output statistics there, workload statistics, that sort of thing. And then lastly, we have statistics for the enforcement program. I say that just so you'll know that as I start through on page 18, I'm going to talk about the program, and then I'll talk about the performance measures that relate to that program, and so you'll notice that they're out of order. Okay? We've talked a little bit about the consumer education program. Again, we think that this is the area where the agency can have one of its best benefits. We use about 1% of the agency resources right now on that, and that, for the most part, involves us going to home shows, interacting with consumers. These home shows, or perhaps you've been to one or two, are popular. They tend to bring out people that are thinking about home improvements, and that's a good place for us to interact and make sure that people know what kind of products we have to help them and what they might want to look for when they hire a construction contractor. Currently, we have both educations in one bucket, both consumer as well as contractor education. So contractor education and testing is run by the same program. We have statutory authority and mandate to require applicants for licensure to be involved with 16 hours, that's clock hours of education, and then to have a test. We've developed a manual. I hope to bring it. I didn't bring it today. Looks a little bit like a Salem phone book. It's that thick. It's divided into chapters that have to do with contractors' business activities, whether it be with regulation, DEQ, codes, all the myriad that a contractor is going to deal with when they get into business. That program has been successful, we believe. It improves every year. The course manual is on its fifth edition, so it continues to improve. And today, when a person goes and takes that test, it's an open book test. And that's a bit of a change for us. I can argue both sides of that coin, whether it should be open book or closed book. I can say that the open book test has slightly increased the passage rate. But I can also tell you that if you took the book and didn't take the class and didn't study, you won't pass the test, because the amount of information in there is very, very large. We're hoping that at the end of the day, I don't know what your experience in school was, but when I would cram, I would remember material for about the length of time it took me to stop the test. And we want contractors not to just know the material for one day. We want them to have a resource so they go back to it, and when they have a problem with DEQ or they have a problem with the permitting authority, that they're able to open that book and say, here's the access. Here's the place I need to go to get the information I need. One of the reasons why we went to an open book test.
Question. Thank you. As a former teacher, I think that's a great approach for some things, because you have to become familiar with the book, and that's, I think, is part of what your purpose is, and not just memorize something, but know where to find it. That's the important thing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Greg, could you talk a little bit about what's required of existing license holders? Any kind of renewal, continuing education?
It'll be a short response. Senator Morris, currently there is no continuing education for contractors. And it's a hotly debated topic. Many professions require it. I know the Landscape Board is considering, and I believe they have a bill in this session, to require it. There are some contractor groups, I think, that are interested in it. And I think someday we'll have it. I think it makes a lot of sense. But my temperature of the industry right now is that they don't want it yet. And so currently, we don't have that as a requirement for licensure.
Could you address the source of disputes or complaints by new licensees versus long-standing businesses?
Morris, I want to make sure I've got a good handle on your question.
Well, my question is, if we're talking about continuing education and the need for people to be informed, if you go back and look at your source of where the complaints come from, do they come from the new contractors primarily? Do they come from the older contractors? And I guess what's behind my question is that if you have a majority of your complaints are from long-standing contractors, there might be a basis statistically to look at continuing education.
Senator Morris and members of the committee, I think that's absolutely correct. One of the difficulties we have is in trying to determine whether or not a complaint against a contractor in the dispute resolution program is an indicator that the contractor's got a problem or not. In many cases, for example, a home inspecting business could inspect 10 homes a day, 300 days a year, 3,000 possible disputes with a homeowner. A home builder, a small home builder, may only build 2 homes a year. So the likelihood of the inspector getting a complaint may be greater, much greater than the home builder. Yet, you get the same claim. So we have a little problem with that issue. It's one of the reasons why we developed the performance measures the way we did and took a look at the ratio of devastating or disaster, and that we define as a bankruptcy. And when you take a look at those numbers, clearly the contractors who have taken the education are much less likely to go bankrupt, the statistics show, than a contractor who has never had any of the education. We take that as an indication that we like to believe that it shows that the program is working, the education program. But one could easily also conclude that continuing education could be.
Well, welcome the official chair.
Good morning, and Representative Smith is right behind. I apologize to the panel and the witnesses. We had meetings with the co-chairs this morning, so he's right behind me.
Thank you. That does take us to page 20 in the presentation. It shows a little bit graphically how many folks, how many businesses that we currently license have this education background. And again, we license businesses, so what this shows is that somebody in the business, we call them a responsible managing individual, has taken the test. And today, of our total number of licensees, 18% have taken the test. And of course, that's up from zero in the year 2000. That would take us to our performance measure, where I might be able to talk to you about the information that I was sharing with you about the problem with bankruptcies. That's on page number 21. This is kind of a busy graph here, but if I can go through it, spend a little bit of time on it, I can show you, I think, why we believe this is important. The data is on line item number 4. The performance measure is the percent of CCB-tested contractors that file bankruptcy. So we're looking at only the tested contractors and what percentage. And it's less than 1%. But it's interesting to see that in compared to the non-tested contractors. So line 4 is the ratio of tested contractors that file for bankruptcy. And on line 3, you see the ratio of non-tested contractors. And in this last year, 0.067% for tested, and almost over a third of a percent for non-tested.
I'm confused about that. Given that I'm struggling to see the correlation between the test and bankruptcy, I think that folks would readily acknowledge that there are all kinds of catastrophic problems that would drive a person or a corporation into bankruptcy. And I don't know how your performance measure deals with those things that are beyond your ability to control and don't correlate to the test. Catastrophic illness, those sorts of things.
Senator Johnson, you're absolutely correct. We believe that there are life-altering events that perhaps play a bigger role in these bankruptcies than Construction Contractors Board. But I guess we had a difficult time trying to find something, some kind of a measure, some kind of an output measure for education and test.
Why not complaints?
Okay. Senator Johnson, it's a good question. And I talked about that a little earlier our problem with complaints is it's difficult to weigh for the contractor who has 10 jobs a day. I was in the insulation business, okay, and on some days I would install insulation in 5 homes a day. Perhaps I had 1,000 homes a year. And I'm all, you know, when you got that kind of volume, you're going to have some problems with some people, even if you're perfect. And other businesses build 1 or 2 homes. They might just get lucky. And so to measure just the complaints didn't seem to make a lot of sense to us. And we believe that the life-altering experiences for both tested as non-tested contractors would be the same if you have a big enough sample. So if the only difference between the two samples is the education, and if you buy the proposition that the education helps a person from going broke, going out of business because they understand business activities, then perhaps it is a measure that works.
I guess I'm still struggling with going broke versus satisfying customers. And it just seems to me that going broke represents such a far stop over. I mean, what's the purpose of the test?
Mr. Johnson, the purpose of the test is to measure whether or not the applicant has assimilated the information in the education. And, of course, the purpose of the education is perhaps your real question. Is to provide contractors with the tools necessary, we believe, to have a successful business so that they don't run afoul of the law.
Or don't leave in their wake a whole bunch of unhappy customers who never call them back again, which circles me back to the complaint piece. I'm just struggling to understand the correlation between the test and bankruptcy. I may be the only one on the panel that's missing it, but I just don't get that piece.
Madam Chair, I concur to some extent. I mean, it's obvious that if a contractor is engaged in continuing education and learning the most that they can about the new changes and developments in their industry, they're probably going to be better business people ultimately. But I think the real measure here that we need to get at is the measure of how we are, what are our outcomes with the people we serve. Contractors, how well are they satisfying their customers? And you have a customer satisfaction survey here, and it relates to claims and a number of things. Ultimately, any educational component, in my mind, Madam Chair, would want to result in the focus not being less bankruptcies, but rather the focus being better satisfied customers leading to less claims. I know it's not that simple, but I would concur with you. I think that's the measure that's the ultimate measure for me of agency performance.
Senator Morsak.
I think what you're measuring is valid if you do a follow-up and determine why people are leaving business. Is that a difficult thing to do? It's one more step, but I mean, it just seems to me, if you want to prove a point that education is a determining factor by itself, then you might do a follow-up survey.
Senator Johnson, Senator Morris said, I'm not positive we could survey all the folks that went out of business. In many cases, if they're gone. But one of our problems is that, as I indicated, or thought patterns is that we'll determine that debt and we'll hold that business responsible for the debt unless it's dissolved in bankruptcy. And that's where the consumer really gets it. Because if it's dissolved in bankruptcy, not only will the consumer never see that money, but the business person can go right back into business and perhaps make the same kind of mistake they made in the first place. And that's the insidious thing about it. All but for the bankruptcy law, we're able to keep people who mess up big time out of the business. But it's a federal issue. It's a constitutional issue. In some cases, it's a reasonable issue. But in years past, it's been my experience that some people file bankruptcy awfully fast and then move on to another business and file bankruptcy again and again, and consumers get it. this is one of the reasons why it's kind of high on my list. I wouldn't argue the point that it perhaps isn't the best measure of success for the education program.
Okay.
We do have a customer satisfaction survey that's not a performance measure, but we do track it for how well the education providers do their job, as well as the testing. It's not in here, but we do measure those things.
I apologize for missing the first part of your presentation, but out of your universe of 35,000 people that haven't taken the test, or 41,000 of licensees, what are you doing to encourage people to take the test?
Senator Johnson, referring to the people who have never had to take the education or test?
Mm-hmm.
We make the book available. In years past, we did have a proposition to use our resources to provide a copy of the manual to all licensed contractors. That didn't meet with the Assembly's approval, and so we didn't bring that back this time.
Let me just make sure that I understand this in the presentation. You have a whole body of people who are grandfathered, do you not?
Yes, ma'am.
And just attrition and time will eventually flush them through, and then you'll get to a point where you have 100% as new businesses and contractors are coming online.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Are there any considerations of a way to incentivize that grandfathered bunch?
A good idea. I hadn't really thought of it. And let me give that some thought. Any suggestions? I recall last biennium, the education and testing was an interest of yours, and if you've got any suggestions as to how we might do that.
One that I don't even, I'm making this up as I'm talking to you, so I don't know what the bars are about it, but if there was a way to get some kind of a break on liability coverage, if you had demonstrated that you had taken a test that showed knowledge of current industry practices, something about best business practices, something about, I don't know what the whole universe of the questions are on the test, but it seems to me that the insurance industry would welcome a uniformly high-performing tested pool of contractors, and if there was some way to get some break there. There may be some equal protection issues. There may be some stuff I haven't even thought about, but it would sure be a starting place if I were sitting in your shoes.
Madam Chair, I would say to you that that thought crossed my mind earlier when I looked at this graph, thinking, how can we incentivize? And then hearing Craig talk about other being hotly debated within the industry about having continuing education requirements. It would seem to me that it would be, you're in the aviation business, and we're familiar with the more sophisticated aircraft become, the more your level of training has to become for your crews, not because it's demanded by the FAA, but rather by the insurance industry for insurance reasons. And I think that probably applies here. It would be great to have the industry say, insurance industry say, why don't we offer a break for those that complete the courses and have a, and it's kind of like an experience rating we have with workers' comp. Your experience rating is better, you're going to get a better rate.
Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, possibly one of the things to use would be an index of percent of complaints versus volume of work or something, and those that are in that very high profile complaint category, that there might be an enforcement order that would come that would require some education.
Try to
shape the business up. We ought not to penalize the companies that are well capitalized, well run, and really strong products, customer service. They're not the ones that are in need of continuing education, those that are operating on the edge that probably create the problems. It would be my guess. But that's a subject for a different day, but it's a concept that you might think about.
The other... Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you give any kind of certification if they take the test and pass it? Is that something they could use as part of their advertising? I am a certified contractor.
Senator Johnson, Senator Morissette, yes, they get their license, but that's it. There are other programs. One of them is housed over at the Building Codes Division called a Master Builder Program that really concentrates on codes and some other issues. But we don't have any other kind of certificate currently. And I wanted to get back to Senator Johnson's issue of incentivization. We certainly do currently have statutory authority that if a contractor is in trouble and has a certain number of claims, we can put them on probation and require them to take education. We've done that a little bit in the past. In many cases, what's happened is the contractor has chosen just to go out of business rather than to jump through those hoops. But we do have that authority, and I appreciate you mentioning that. Even though we haven't used it much in the last few months, we do have it.
That might be something you'd think about. And I like what Senator Morissette's saying, that somehow if you advertise to the public that you had a list of approved folks and there was some reason to be on that approved list, there was something that let you put on your brochure that you were a gold star contractor or whatever, some way to make it highly desirable to this 82% to come into the fold. Senator Morrison.
Just a comment. In our business, we set a target of 3%. This was one of our performance measurements. 3% of payroll we would dedicate to education and training. And that that worked for my company. And now one shoe doesn't fit all feet, but I can give testimony to the fact that investing in your company with training and education is a very worthwhile endeavor.
And I would assume at insurance renewal time, that would certainly be something that I would lead with in negotiating with underwriters to cover a complex operation. I'd want somebody to pay attention to the fact that a corporation had made that level of commitment to safe operations and current industry trends.
As you discuss this, it dawns on me that we haven't highlighted the fact that a licensee is a tested licensee before, but I don't know of no reason why we couldn't. And just indicating that would begin to become an incentive for those who haven't in the past tested.
Well, I'd know if I were bidding on a job and I could go and lay down my card that said credentialed in some way that differentiated me from the competition. That would be a boon to my company, and it would be something that I would strive for even if I were not legally required. I'd want to be, I have all the competitive tools at my disposal that my competition would use to have them selected for the job.
Yes.
Okay, we've now interrupted you a whole bunch of times. What page are you on if you could bring the committee with you?
Okay. I think I have exhausted that particular performance measure. That would take us to page number 24.
Okay.
This is the contractor licensing and customer service. Again, these are the folks that handle the paperwork, handle the phone calls, do the walk-in traffic. We have a fairly complex requirement to be licensed. Person has to determine what kind of a independent contractor they're going to be. And that has to do with exempt versus non-exempt. This has to do with workers' comp for the most part. Pick a license category. They have to provide the bond and liability insurance. And as I talked about before, and as most of you are well aware, the liability insurance is a problem. It's a problem that we haven't been able to solve, but we work with the folks in the insurance division as well as the insurance industry to try to address it as best we can. You can imagine, because it's a prerequisite of a license and because many people can't afford it, we have licensees that are very upset with the contractors board. They're upset that their insurance used to be $600. Today it's $6,000. I know of a couple of home builders that pay $1 million for $1 million worth of coverage. It's a problem, and the cost is being downloaded to consumers. Business isn't paying for this. And in some cases, when you talk to the folks that build affordable houses, when you add $1,000 or $2,000 to the price of a home, you're pricing people out of the market, and you're also reducing the amount of business that's going on.
Is it not a bigger problem because our sister state of Washington treats it differently?
Senator Johnson, I haven't heard that. I can tell you that the state of California does not require liability insurance of its contractors. My understanding on the state of Washington is they require about half of what we require.
The only reason I'm familiar with Washington, and this will take you to a conversation that you and I had over the interim, I have a constituent who's a lawyer and had been providing capital for affordable housing and finally decided, why don't I go ahead and take the contractor's exam and become the contractor and cut out the middleman? And she successfully pursued the test, passed it, did everything just right, and found out there was no market for insurance at all. And the upshot of it is, after I asked for the agency's assistance, the upshot is she's gone to Kelso and has found a much favorable insurance climate in Kelso. And so now they're the beneficiaries of affordable housing. And this is not a huge operation. She probably builds one or two units a year. But if people would have houses by virtue of the fact that she's able to provide housing in a certain market. Could you describe to us how you might seek some statutory relief to be able to do something different in Oregon that doesn't put consumers at risk, but makes it possible for contractors to get insurance here?
Senator Johnson, if I knew the answer to that question, I would have been here with a, not here, but somewhere in the Assembly with a bill. We don't have a bill. I can tell you that the construction industry has several things that they're attacking this. They're nibbling away at the edges. One issue of having a better informed labor force, educated contractors, I think will help. This has to do with the litigation and the 10-year tail, if you will. The statute of repose might be lessened. But almost anything you do besides increase the level of proficiency on the part of the contractor is going to have a slightly negative effect for consumers. We need to make it so that people can sell insurance in this state and not lose their business while they're doing that. And as many of you know, what's happened with insurance companies in the state is they've been selling $1 of insurance and paying out $2 in claims. And you can't do that very long and stay in business, so many people have left. And that's driven up the price.
Senator Morris.
Mold claims are a big issue in residential and commercial, industrial construction. And contractors are confronted with the liability when they're just building the product to the standards. And you have tighter buildings, and it's a huge problem. But it seems like every time we try to find solutions, the trial attorneys find ways to stop it. So just to call it the way it is.
Okay. Continue, please, Mr. Smith.
Thank you. That is the customer service and licensing section. We have a couple of performance measures for them. On page number 27.
May I interrupt you one more time? I'm going to take up Representative Smith's favorite cause for a second. When people come in, and you have folks answering telephone inquiries, but when people come in and are interested in becoming a licensed contractor, and they're working on things like getting a payroll set up and complying with all of the applicable laws in the state of Oregon, do your folks give them that level of technical assistance?
Senator Johnson, we don't sit down and counsel the individual applicants in terms of how to set up their business. That's what we hope the education does for them. We do have resources, Small Business Administration suggestions, that sort of thing. But we don't counsel them that way. On the other hand, we'll give them resources to try to get their insurance. We have a market assistance program that we help develop with the insurance division. The counter staff at the board will help the licensee when they come in and they don't have all their paperwork in order. They don't know where to get their assumed business name. They don't know where to go to get their tax ID numbers. So we'll give those kind of assistance, but not how to set up their business. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Can I interrupt really quick?
Representative Smith.
Thank you for taking up the cause. I think, once again, that just highlights an issue that we as a committee here and those of us on the afternoon committee need to keep in the back of our minds about how do we continue to make those linkages between the good folks here and those people we're also putting money into to help with small business startups. And at a future time, maybe in round two, I'd want to have raise the point a little bit more about the need to make sure those partnerships are developed between the Office of Emerging Small Businesses and the Small Business Development Centers and those type of folks to make sure there are linkages. Because I do know the SBDCs frequently send folks to you, and we just need to make sure it's reciprocal and that everyone's working together.
Senator Morrison.
Yeah, thank you. I met with the Lane Community College Small Business Development Program. Do they have these around the state? In every community college, or is that unique?
There's 19 of them.
19 of them. Well, isn't that a source then of that information?
It is, and with the chair's discretion, I think just what we need to be doing is making sure those linkages occur. So if someone from the Eugene area needs help developing their business, maybe doing a business plan or figuring out how to get initial startup capital, but their first step is to these folks. These folks know that they have a partner they can turn to and say, hey, we want to work with you, but really your first step is the Small Business Development Center. You need to talk to them and get your foundation in place before you move forward.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
All right. and I think we are at the performance measure now on page number 25. Percent of contractors satisfied with the agency's processing of license and renewal information. This is a clear customer satisfaction survey. The data is on the last part of this chart here. The agency currently has a fairly high satisfaction level with its licensing and customer satisfaction department.
Yeah, but you appear to be going in the wrong direction, Mr. Smith.
We'll fix that.
How?
Well, we fix that by continuing to. That's a good opportunity for me to turn to the appendix that talks about this a little bit. That's on the second green piece of paper, and I can tell you that. We're improving our statistics. That's the main thing. We're improving our statistics, and we're improving the manner in which we gain information about how well we're doing. The reason I wanted to share this with you was that I wanted to show you how we gather this information. It may be difficult to find, but behind the second green piece of paper, the almost last page, page number 31 in appendix number 2, looks like this, is the survey that we send out to our customers. And the key here is to get them into the customer's hands after we've dealt with them, and then to get the data. The data, if you'll turn to page number 28 and 29, these are comments. And we capture every one of them. These are comments that are written on these. Well, the raw score is important, but if you really want to know how to improve yourself, give a client an opportunity to write something about you, but tell you what you're doing right, tell you what you're doing wrong. These comments are raw. There's been nothing taken out. There's been nothing added. The program manager gets these. If there is a negative comment, and we have the contact information. Sometimes people will tell us who they are. Other times they won't. But if they tell us who they are, she will contact that person, find out exactly what the problem was with the service.
And what was the explanation to Mr. Bales, who wants to know that he's just fixing appliances?
Well, appliances is an interesting, Senator Johnson, appliances is an interesting area. Because if all they're doing is repairing appliances that are not built into the structure, then there's no CCB, there's no construction contract support license required. But many times people are dealing with an appliance that's built into the structure. It's hardwired, it's plumbed. Dishwasher is an example.
Okay.
And in those examples, if it's built into the structure, the definition of a contractor covers those types of works. So the Maytag man repairing a washer and dryer is not required to be licensed.
I would just note for the record that the last comment on page 29 speaks to exactly what we've been talking about. I want to incorporate my business and I will lose my low CCB number, and I'm not happy about that. My number is a good indicator to customers of how long I've been in business. I strongly disagree with the rule. Here's somebody who's very proud of their CCB credential, and I think it speaks to exactly what we were talking about, to incentivize folks to want to go through the testing process.
Sure.
Madam Chair,
Senator,
I have behind the green sheet, I have up to page, the first green sheet up to page 25. Behind the second green sheet, I go up to page 25. Then I get into the
long. Oopsie, I think you've got
shorted
some page.
Senator Johnson, Senator Morissette, do I have a bad packet for you?
It's an unhappy customer you got here.
I just don't go up that high on either page, either.
Thank you.
This is the second green sheet. Okay, good. Thank you.
So again, Senator Johnson, I think the answer to your question is we need to find out where we have shortcomings. We need to find out what our customers' needs are. We need to find ways to meet those needs. That's how we will improve our score.
Okay, but I guess I that's a pretty superficial answer. You're losing a point a year, it looks like to me. The numbers are still very high, and make no mistake, I recognize that. But you're headed in the wrong direction, and have been for 3 years.
Senator Johnson, it's a fair comment. It's something that we noticed as well. To be quite frank with you, I'm not absolutely positive that we can get a whole lot higher than that, but we're going to look for ways to do it.
Reading these comments while you're getting back on the place in the book where you want to continue your presentation is sort of interesting. The fellow who talks about too expensive to obtain a license, the class is $175, the books and tapes are $140, the exam is $160, INTERP, interpreter, I don't know what that means, but that's $90. The license form is, do you charge them once they pass the test another $295 for a license?
Senator Johnson, no, it's just $295.
Okay, that's in addition to the class, the books, the exam. Then they get the license, that's $295. Then the bond is $900. Then the insurance is $2,000. Then workers' comp is $2,000. I'm just looking at the out-the-door costs to get up and set to go. And this is before you pounded a nail.
Senator Johnson, you're absolutely correct. And those costs continue to go up. It's one of the problems I think that we have. It increases the pressure to work illegally. It increases the disparity between the person who's working legally and who isn't. And so the person working illegally can offer a lower price, and consumers are tempted to buy from that person, and then they don't have the same kind of safeguards that the insurance and bond provide. And I think that's a challenge. It's not clear as to whether or not this person was absolutely right on in terms of the bond cost. Usually, the bond cost is between $200 and $300, but. And we have some fairly good statistics to show that. But unfortunately, in the bonding business, what they're oftentimes using is a credit score for insurance as well. and if the credit score is bad by the individual, or if they've had to pay out a bond in the past, the cost of a bond can be higher than the average. But the vast majority, 95%, pay around $300 for that bond.
Do you buy your curriculum? When it says books and tapes and the class, who develops the curricula that you use?
The curriculum is developed by the agency. It has volunteers that help write the manual. And then it has a contract with a private provider to take that course content, take that manual content, produce a manual, and then the manual is, by contract, capped at a certain price that it can offer that for sale. Currently, that's $37.50.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to follow you back to page
12. I think that takes care of the customer satisfaction for licensing. That would get to our page number 27. This is a performance measure that looks at the total number of times that the agency touches a customer in terms of its desire to speak to us or we speaking to them. It adds up website hits, telephone calls, home show contacts, speeches, and attempts to quantify how many times we are touching those individuals. You talk about things going the wrong way. Clearly, we're not going the right direction here. And as I analyze this, website hits are down significantly. I can't tell you why. It's a concern. Telephone calls are down, but we believe sometimes the telephone calls are down less because we are actually processing licenses quicker. So people aren't calling back and forth. So that may not be a great indication that people aren't desiring to talk to us.
How do you correlate this data against your complaints? Because what I'm trying to figure out is that if your contacts are going down, your customer satisfaction is going down, and the price is going up, and the incentive, the difficulty, the barriers to getting insurance is going up. I'm just trying to figure out when does the amalgam of all of the difficulties that somebody faces getting into business become so daunting that they say, I don't want to go there, and you now are creating a whole bunch of unlicensed contractors.
And Senator Johnson, I think you're absolutely correct, is that as we put barriers to this field, but I think that's true in almost any field, but this is an interesting field because if you're doing home improvement, you don't necessarily have to have a shingle. If you're practicing law, if you're practicing medicine, if you're practicing a lot of other professions, people expect you to be properly licensed and tested. But in order to put a new window in your home, you may not think that you need to have a licensed professional. And we have folks going around, particularly away from Salem on the coast, eastern Oregon, southern Oregon. In some of those communities, folks don't think that a license has value. And therefore, both the consumers and the contractors, in some cases, work without a license, and in some cases, people get burned. To answer your question of what to do about it, the best thing we can do about it is try to keep costs down. We can't do too much about the regulation other than to provide those policymakers that make those rules information about what it will do if you add regulation. We didn't used to have a test, we now have it. We didn't used to have the education requirement, now we have it. It certainly is a policy determination whether or not you want to have education or testing. But at the very least, if we're going to have it, have a good one. Have one that people can pass. Have one that's not cost prohibitive. Today, I think the main thing that's cost prohibitive is the insurance. And what we're doing on that is to work with those people that I told you about, both the insurance division and the insurance industry, as well as our partners in the construction industry, who do have some policy issues before you that might affect this issue. One of them, and I can't tell you it's a great idea or a bad idea, is the concept of a recovery fund. And the recovery fund would need to be funded. The problem with that particular bill is it would take a hit to the general fund. That recovery fund is a concept of taking the penalties that the that the Construction Contractors Board issues against non-licensed people for the most part, and using that money to try to build up a reservoir of money that would be paid to consumers that aren't made whole by the bond. Now, that's about $400,000 to $500,000 a biennium. It's fees that we collect, or I should say penalties that we collect. But I'm not certain that, again, in today's climate with the need for general fund, I'm not sure that one's going to fly.
How are you doing on your collections?
Collections is a challenge. I can tell you that we collect about one out of every $4 that we assess. It's about 25%. I'm told that that's not bad for people, for the kind of people that we assess money damages against. Remember that these people, for the most part, are not established businesses. They're folks with pickup trucks that come across the border and back. Once the heat raises here, they go back down to Arizona or wherever they came from or work down there for a while. We have a robust collection process. It starts with a couple of letters from CCB. If it's a licensed contractor, we take the license away. If the letters don't work, we go to the Department of Revenue. Revenue has a pretty good collections department. They collect a substantial amount of money for us. They'll go against tax returns. They'll garnish wages if the person's around. We will issue liens against any property that the violator has. That will sometimes yield a result years down the road, but it still yields. We'll get checks for $4,000 or $5,000 from a penalty issued 10 years ago when a property sells.
You turn those liens over to anybody, like any of the big credit reporting organizations, Equifax or TransUnion or any of those?
Senator, I'd have to get back to you on that. I don't know whether we advise credit companies of our liens.
Could you get back to us on that? Because it certainly seems as if you're looking for a hammer, that's one.
Okay. When that doesn't work, when all else fails, and of course, like I say, we don't ever forgive these deaths, by the way. These deaths remain on the books, and if the person ever comes back into the state and wants to make it right, we collect the debt if they want to get licensed. And that's what happens sometimes. People end up working without a license. They get a fine, a large fine. They move out of state, go to California, go to Idaho, wherever. Then they come back in. Perhaps they're more mature. They want to make it right, and we collect the money then. After we get done with the Department of Revenue, and they are unsuccessful, we turn over to private collections. Private collections are a resource. They don't collect a lot. By that time, most of the blood's been squeezed.
Going back to your performance measures on page 27, these are the times that you reach out and touch your customers.
Senator Johnson, it's a little bit of an amalgamation, because the website hits are people reaching to us.
Okay.
The phone calls are people reaching to us. The board packets or the packets of material is literature we're mailing to others. The home shows are when we go out to a home show and people come to the booth and talk to us. And of course, the speech contacts are proactive. We go and talk to groups.
Okay, I'm just trying to figure out in this customer contact world where you have contact with the customers of your customers. Where's the measure of how much public education you're doing about the need to do business with certified contractors, the need to check the credentials, the need to check the existence of a bond or insurance? I'm thinking about the guy who puts out a very attractive sign on the highway that says cabinets, and has all the appearance of being a substantial person in operation, in business, installs stuff in someone's home, the work's faulty, the person seeks redress and discovers there's no license, no insurance, no bond, and where's the customer, you informing the shopping public about the necessity of doing business with only certified contractors?
Senator Johnson, it's the message I want to leave you with today. If there's nothing else that you hear, that's the area that we try to do our best in, but frankly, we're looking for some additional resources. The way we do that is telephone calls to us. Home shows is perhaps the best place we do that, because home shows are areas where we have modified, a person who's looking for a home improvement. They're walking through, they're seeing the fancy windows and doors, and then they see CCB, or the Construction Contractors Board booth, state licensing. And we're able to talk to that person. We have a slogan called Inquire Before You Hire. It's a kind of a catchy thing, but we're trying to tell the consumer at that point, look, the state's not going to pick you up if you fall down completely, but there's a few things that you can do to protect yourself. At the very least, understand what the regulatory scheme is. We have a license, we have a bond, we have an agency that receives complaints. Check with that agency to find out if that person is licensed, and try to find out what kind of a history they've had. How long have they been licensed? What is their claims record? And we're able to get that out to a degree, but we spend about 1% of our budget on it currently. We'd like to spend more. I don't want to put her on the spot, but it's one of the reasons why I brought the program manager for that section in today. She does a marvelous job with the tools that we give her, but she's trying to do about 3 different jobs at one time. And there probably isn't a better place for us to put funds than to prevent problems from happening. We do that with contractors by giving them an education and test. We do what we can with consumers. We've done some radio spots. We've done many speeches to consumer groups. We do the home shows. We're looking for some creative ways to do more.
It seems to me that you have some natural partners. Most people that are having major work done somehow interact with the power company or the gas company or somebody providing the juice to run a new kitchen. Have you explored the possibility of doing inserts in bills? Or, she's nodding, yes. Good morning. Would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Good morning, Senator Johnson. My name is Sally Ridenour, and I'm the education manager for the Construction Contractors Board.
For the benefit of the staff, would you mind spelling your last name?
Ridenour.
Thank you.
The education section, like Craig said, is funded. It's about 1% of our funding. We have 2 staff people, myself and my assistant. So we have some limited resources that we have to work with. We do about 25 home shows a year. We do about 45 speeches to different types of consumer groups, neighborhood associations, senior groups, Chamber of Commerce, all sorts of civic organizations. We have in the past partnered with utility companies to do billing inserts. We're constantly working with other state agencies like Building Codes Division, Securities Division, Insurance Division, and trying to share resources and get the word out using partnerships as best as we can. We've also done some mass media advertising, non-paid advertising, as well as a little bit of paid advertising. The biggest problem is time. Basically, my one staff person does all the consumer education, and I handle all the contractor education. And with just the 2 of us, it's very difficult to reach over 3 million Oregonians with our messages.
Senator Morse.
Maybe I didn't hear you say Chambers of Commerce. Did you say?
Yes.
Okay.
And how about subsets of those? Because most chamber newsletters that I'm familiar with are begging for stories So instead of you going out and doing speechifying, which takes time and travel and expense, to just send them news stories to drop into their newsletters. So many of those folks are just dying for stories.
Senator Johnson, Senator Morissette, we do that. One of the best ways to get that kind of information out to consumers is by establishing those relationships. And sometimes that takes a face-to-face relationship to make that connection with that chamber, with that local consumer group, and then get the opportunity to put things in the newsletters. But we do take advantage of those opportunities when we are able to.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you. I will call my chamber in Springfield today and find out what the relationship is, just out of curiosity, and I'll let you know tomorrow.
One other thing that occurs to me is that some of the very high-profile home builder, I see ads for the Street of Dreams and those sorts of things where you have a high volume of people. I'm going to guess that they might be fairly sophisticated consumers, but do you ever do any of those events?
In my tenure with the agency, we have not. We may have in the past, but that is one thing that we can take a look at doing.
Could you bring us, don't make this an exhaustive list, but if you could bring us a little summary of just where you do your outreach, that would be very helpful.
Certainly.
Okay. And the approximate, and I mean approximate, do not spend tonight working on this, but the approximate cost per contact, if you have like a brochure or a newsletter or featured articles in some of the inserts that go in the newspaper. I'm just trying to get a scope of the cost to reach out. Okay. Thank you. Okay. I think we're on page, heading over into enforcement.
All right. Page number 30 is the enforcement program. As I've indicated, enforcement is just as it sounds. These are the folks that take disciplinary actions against non-licensed contractors. We have the small section that deals with construction fraud, and then the larger section that deals with non-licensed activity and other contractor regulation that sometimes is not properly adhered to. You can look at this agency or this program in three different units. The administrative sanctions unit that takes actions against contractors by issuing penalties and so forth. The regional investigator program, these are the 12 contracts that we have with private investigators that go around to job sites, check and determine if a license is active, make sure that people are not hiring employees if they're not properly licensed to do so, that sort of thing. And then the Special Investigations Unit. Special Investigations Unit, as I've indicated, is a partnership. We have one staff that deals with it, but then we have some highly trained individuals, people that understand white-collar crime as well as construction crime. We work with local district attorneys, local police departments. The partnerships there are ever-changing, but one of the problems we have is we'll train a DA and we'll get build a relationship with the DA. That person will change over in 6 months, and now we're at ground zero again. But without those kinds of partnerships, we can't get the criminal activities prosecuted, and so we put some effort into that. One of the performance measures that we took a look at here was an efficiency one, is the average days to close an enforcement investigation. Here, I think one way to look at this is that any kind of behavior modification analysis clearly shows if you don't issue the penalty quickly, it doesn't tend to extinguish the bad behavior. And so not only do our complainants demand that we operate fast, but the ability to dissuade illegal activity is somewhat contingent upon the agency properly taking the agency action quickly. We had three steady years of decline, or four steady years of decline. In 2004, we've bumped up, and of course we're sensitive to that, and we're looking for ways to reverse that. Uh, Another important performance measure would be the rate at which offenders reoffend. Recidivism is a function of taking a look at whether or not an individual gets disciplined in one period of time and then reoffends. Traditionally in corrections, you take a look at people on probation. We don't put people on probation, but we can take a look, if we properly set this program up, at folks that have been disciplined for working without a license for a period of time and then measure anywhere during that period of time if they have reoffended. We are not absolutely sure that the current methodology is accurate. Currently what we're looking at here is we're taking a look at all of the people that we took an action against and then measuring how many of those are repeat offenders. And that's different than a traditional recidivism rate. And so we are, although we're going to continue to measure this, we're taking a look at a better way to measure recidivism. And the things that you can modify here is the size of the penalty. You know, how often are you going to give a person a $500 penalty versus a $5,000 penalty? When do you stop from doing civil penalties and start looking at Unlawful Trade Practice Act violation or a criminal offense? So these kinds of progressive disciplines, if the discipline that we're invoking right now isn't stopping recidivism, perhaps we need to ratchet it up. But as I write here, one of the things that is in play is the difficulty to have a legal business. And for the most part, that's insurance. That takes us to our dispute resolution program. I've talked a little bit about dispute resolution. It is, again, a fairly unique program in terms of regulatory agencies in this state as well as most other states. You can think of it as similar to a court proceeding. We have currently a notice requirement, so if you're going to file a claim against a contractor, you need to write a letter to that contractor stating that you're going to do so. And there's a $50 fee. And those two things have combined to reduce claims significantly. We'd like to think that it's reducing claims that are frivolous or otherwise without merit. But what I can tell you is it's cut the number of claims almost in half. What's left are the tougher claims, the claims that are fairly complex, and staff continues to work with those.
One of the things that I have listened as the hearings progressed this morning that you've said over and over and over again, and it's one where I think maybe you guys could play a role of tremendous service both to your customers and to the state, and that's the whole exploration of this insurance business. How long until we basically put small contractors out of business? What you all have done to put yourself in a leadership role in trying to find solutions, that's the piece that's missing for me. And I may be overcharging your agency in trying to find a solution, but it certainly seems to me that given your regulatory responsibilities and the fact that you're asserting a leadership role in trying to bring a whole community of business people into compliance with respect to testing, that figuring out is there a leadership role for your agency in the whole debate about insurance? Could you convene your colleagues, home builders, contractors, other folks, trade associations, to put together some kind of a summit on insurance and what it is that the state might do to try to make it possible for people to go into a very honorable profession and comply with the law more fully?
Senator Johnson, I think you're absolutely right. I think there is a leadership role for the agency. This is a topic that's on every agenda of a board meeting. To date, what the agency has done is not sufficient. I can report to you that we have been in contact with the governor's office about this matter. I can report to you that the board has, for the first time in my memory, this board has never passed a resolution. As a matter of fact, when one of the board members wanted to do that, I had to look it up exactly how you're going to do it. But they passed a resolution indicating that this was an emergency, that this agency needs to devote its resources to finding solutions. For that reason, it's high on the agenda of every meeting. Besides reaching out to the governor's office, we have a partnership with Corey Streisinger and all the good people over at DCBS, as well as Joel Ario. We worked, as I think you were here when I talked about the market assistance program, and we work hand-in-hand with the industry. One of the largest suppliers of insurance provides more insurance than any other person, is a relatively small company, and they have developed a special kind of insurance product, and we've been helping them with that, that will be perhaps a solution for some of these small contractors.
And when would it be reasonable for the legislature to look for a suite of recommendations or some work product? I mean, you've called fire alarm, and hopefully the fire trucks are rolling. When do we get to a point where you say, after the identification of an emergency, after the convocation of our legitimate partners in discussing possible solutions, we're now ready to recommend to the policymakers that you take a look at this suite of potential fixes? When's that part happen?
Senator Johnson, I think it's Senate Bill 116 is in Senator Metzger's, Senator Metzger's committee. This is a regulatory modification in insurance law that would make it a little bit easier to set up market assistance programs and other types of regulatory manipulations with the insurance industry. We have worked with Corey, provide her information on that, and I recently provided Senator Metzger with some background detail about the size and scope of the problem.
This is your bill?
It's not my bill. This is DCBS's bill, Senate Bill 116. There are other bills that construction contractors work. Quite frankly, we're not insurance people. I wish I was smart enough to know the answer to this. I'm not. So what we have been trying to do is to make sure folks understand that there is a problem and do what we can do, which is to measure the size of it. And Senator Metzger has my report, a rather detailed report, that indicates the end result of about five quarters worth of survey data that shows the size and scope of this problem. I can tell you that it appears, I emphasize appears, to be getting slightly better. I can show you some of the numbers here. One of the measures is there's an insurance product called surplus lines. Okay, surplus lines is insurance by other people, not necessarily regulated at the same degree as Oregon insurance companies authorized, but they kind of sit out on the periphery. And when an insurance market goes hard, these surplus lines people come in and sell more because they can sell at higher rates. And we've been measuring the ratio of surplus lines versus authorized providers, and it's starting to change. So we're having more authorized providers providing our licensees with insurance and a few less surplus lines. And, of course, we're sharing that information.
Good. Thank you.
The dispute resolution program services complaints against contractors. About 54% are homeowner claims. The other claims come from business to business. This could be sub against general versus sub. Material suppliers constitute a lot of the complaints, failure to pay for material suppliers. Excuse me. And then a few of the claims come from employees for failing to pay wages.
And on those wage disputes, do you work with Foley on those, or how do you go about resolving those?
Senator Johnson, we do work with Foley. We have a good relationship with Foley. Oftentimes, Foley sends those kind of complaints to CCB because we have the mechanism to establish the debt and then to pay the debt, in as much as we have the lever to take the contractor's license away or to go against the contractor's bond. performance measures for this section have to do with the efficiency or the average days it takes to process a claim. You can see on page number 39, we have made significant progress over the past 5 years, but we bumped up in 2004. And I have to report to you that the preliminary numbers for 2005 are not looking good. Now, what they tell me, and I believe them, my staff, is that there was an unintended consequence of the notice and the fee that has lengthened the time it takes to process a claim by 30 to 45 days. It takes time to get the invoice out and to grab the fee, and it also takes time that when a person has filed a complaint, if they failed to give the notice, now we've just set things back for 30 days. So those items have pushed the preliminary numbers for 05 up significantly. We're looking for ways to cut days off the processing. I'm not confident we're going to be able to get it down the way we want to.
Give us a for instance.
As to how that affects?
No. You're looking for ways to cut. Tell us what you're doing, specifics.
Anytime that there is a piece of mail comes into the agency, looking for ways to make sure that that piece of mail gets to the claims examiner and gets identified and processed as soon as possible. I tell you, Senator Johnson, it would be more fruitful for me to get with my program manager on that and have him make a list and have that for you.
That's fine. It doesn't have to be exhaustive, but I mean, when you just say getting the mail to somebody faster, that doesn't strike me as something that needs a whole lot of study.
Right.
Madam Chair.
Representative Larkin.
I want to make sure we're operating on the same premise too. Are you telling us that the 140 days that you had in 2004 is not acceptable, or because of some of the things you've mentioned, do you think you're doing a pretty good job at 140 days?
I think, Senator Johnson, Representative Akian, I think we can do better.
Okay.
I'm not confident that these targets that were set 2 years ago prior to the implementation of this notice and fee are ever going to be obtainable, and that's what I'm concerned about.
Senator
Morrison.
Yeah. Well, maybe you have to look at what caused the unintended consequences and go back and figure out if that was what is, if that's serious enough to make a change.
That makes sense.
Okay. Please continue.
Moving on, that takes us to page number 41, which is the percent of licensed contractors operating in Oregon that fail to pay claim orders for damages. And here we have been making some steady progress. The chart is on page 42. The data here is the line number 7 in our chart. You can see that the percent, it's less than 10%, but it's been going down since 2002. And we hope to reach a figure of 0.5% next year. Also of import to this particular program is, you know, this is in essence, this is a... This plays a mediator role or an arbiter role. And if the public doesn't have confidence that the agency is neutral in the processing of these claims, then we suffer. And that's difficult because quite often we have winners and losers. And it's not uncommon for a loser to think they didn't get a fair shot or to think that we were biased. Nevertheless, we measure that. It's an important measurement, and that's described in performance measure number 8 on page number 43, which is a percent of parties and claims who perceive the Construction Contractors Board process to be fair and impartial.
Well, respectfully, that's lovely. You got 80% saying they do. What about the 20? How instructive is what the 20 is telling you?
Representative Johnson, I think it's instructive. Clearly there's room for improvement.
I guess maybe I wasn't specific enough. What kinds of things are they telling you? I would assume somebody who walks away from a dispute resolution without the answer that they want is disgruntled and might perceive your process as biased. But do you have any mechanism to glean why 20% feel as though they're not getting a square shake?
Representative Johnson, the answer is yes. We do a similar customer satisfaction survey as the product that you saw for licensing, wherein we capture those comments. Sometimes those comments, although I don't have those with me today, sometimes those comments are very frank. And whether they're frank or not, sometimes they are, let's just say that they give room for us to evaluate our program, take a look and see if there's a way for us to improve our product.
Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you survey both sides of the parties in the dispute and then put them into one data set? It seems to me that you've got automatically a skewed result, because most likely the claimant and the party being claimed against, they're going to be automatically on two sides of the issue. I'm wondering how you could have meaningful data.
Well, Senator Johnson, Senator Morris, we do have a mechanism to separate. We do survey both sides, because, frankly, we want both sides to think we're fair regardless of the outcome of the dispute. We do have a mechanism, however, to divide and take a look at just the claimants and to see if their ratio of satisfaction is different than the ratio of satisfaction for respondents. But in my analysis of this, I want them both to think, regardless of the outcome, and when we take a look at this, half the time respondents win or contractors win, half the time claimants win. It's pretty well down the middle. But I want them both to think that the agency was fair, regardless of the outcome.
Okay.
That would conclude my presentation on the performance measures.
Okay.
The next page in the packet, on page number 45, are budget priorities. It's our belief that the core of the agency's ability to get anything done is its licensing and customer service. And so without that, there is little else. But after that, I'd like to think that the consumer and contractor education gets the biggest advantage for Oregonians. Our dispute resolution program uses a lot of our resources, but there's tremendous advantage there. One thing I hadn't talked about that I'd like to make sure is clear is that contractors tell us, and it's not that we try to make it tough, but having a claim against your license is not an enjoyable experience. It colors the license. There's a black mark against you. You've got to end up going to hearings. Some you might lose even though you think you might win. And so just having the product there and accessible prevents some disputes. It motivates contractors to try to stay on the right side of the contract. So there's that advantage. And it's hard to measure that, but we think that that's an important advantage in addition to the millions of dollars that we return to consumers' pockets. We also have the enforcement program at number four, and then administration last.
I guess I need a little help in just grappling with this. You've got 82% of your universe who you have no control over. 18% that you do. Is that not correct?
Senator Johnson, I'm not clear.
Well, for the people that are taking the testing is a requirement to get a license. So out of this grandfathered universe, there are 40,000 people. 82% of them you don't have any control over.
Senator Johnson, I would agree that we don't have any testing or control over them, and we don't have any requirement for continuing education.
They're licensed, though.
They are licensed.
All Okay. Then I've mischaracterized it.
That would take us to page number 47, which is our detail of the 10% reduction as approved, provided to legislative fiscal. We would hope that we wouldn't be put in a position that we need to reduce our budget. If indeed we had to, this is the way we would recommend those cuts occur. The first thing that we would consider cutting, or recommend that you consider cutting, would be our Special Investigations Unit, DOJ funding. Now, the reason why we would do that is we would maintain our ability to get Unlawful Trade Practice Act violations through local law enforcement. DOJ partnership is important to us, but if we had to cut, that would be the first place that we would choose to recommend that we be cut. Secondly, and it's also a finite number, we can identify it. Special Investigations Unit outside contractors is another $165,000. If we had to cut, we'd still have one staff left that could do that, though they wouldn't have additional resources from the outside staff. Number three would be our regional investigation folks. These are the individuals who do the site checks. And then lastly, reduce the amount on hearings.
Any questions with Representative Vakia?
I'm guessing you're going to end in a couple minutes.
I am.
And the board's back tomorrow.
We have actually completed their presentation up to this point. I'm going to ask them to get written responses back to the professional staff, and they'll distribute it to the whole committee.
Then the question is, with respect to these various reductions, I would be curious why you would be reducing these services when you've got a six-month cushion of reserves of approximately $3 million, and that you could reduce that cushion by a couple months or three as opposed to reducing the services. And I'd be happy for you to just give that to us in writing if you'd rather.
I think we'd like to see that in writing.
Okay.
Any other questions?
No, but just a comment.
Senator Morsak.
I just happened to bring my Associated General Contractors Columbia, Oregon Columbia chapter cup with me today.
And I think there are certain people in the audience who appreciate that deeply.
Right, the special one.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. I just want to follow up with a previous comment I had earlier. When we get to round two, can you be prepared to share with us the communication you would have with the Small Business Development Center and how you can partner more with them? Because that'll be a question I'll probably stick on a little bit in round two.
Okay, any other questions? Any comments from the professional staff?
No, Madam Chair. If there's anything you specifically need from me, I'll get the written responses from Mr. Smith and distribute them prior to phase two, and if you have any other issues that arise before we get scheduled for that, let me know, and so I can do it.
Well, we were scheduled for 2 days. Given that we have moved through the presentation expeditiously, there will be no meeting tomorrow. And we will then we lose you, so we'll meet again on Wednesday. And with that, I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5012. And absent any comments from the committee, declare us adjourned without exception.